You are listening to a sermon by Lauren Wilkinson, recorded on Sunday, November 17th, 2024, at Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you. Well, it's good to be back with you again, although we can all agree, I suppose, that with is maybe not quite the best word to describe a Zoom call, but we'll make the best of it. Rosie asked me last summer if I would give three talks about this book of mine, which was published about a year ago. This is a picture of the book. In many ways, this book sums up the understanding of God and creation we've come to as a result of teaching nearly 40 years at Rosie. And I'm happy to share it with you. I titled my talk 3 weeks ago, "What is Creation Waiting For?" And both the wording of that question and the immediate answer comes from Paul's words in Romans 8:19, that the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. I didn't realize until I heard it this morning that that same phrase, the revealing of the children of God, occurs again in the John 1 reading that we had this morning. Creation is waiting for we human beings to be revealed as the children of God. What does that mean? Well, we'll explore more of that actually next week. But I want to focus today on creation and its relationship to Christ. And creation has been waiting for us a very long time. We now know that those words in the beginning, in Genesis 1, "Let there be light," were spoken over 13 billion years ago. Here's a picture of the thought experiment I shared with you the last time I talked. It crowds the history of the universe into a single year. In that cosmic year, beginning with God's Big Bang on January 1st, we don't have the Earth until August. We don't have life until September. The first mammals show up in late December, and the first humans a few minutes before midnight on December 31st. I remind us of these facts about the age and size of the universe, not to make us feel small, just the opposite. When we understand the scale of God's project in creation, that can give us a sense of the importance of the role we, children of God, are to play in it. And it's important, too, to be reminded that the story that the Bible is telling and the story that science is telling are about the same world, not a religious one accessed by faith and a scientific one accessed by, you know, the data and research. The answer in Romans that creation is waiting for the revealing of the children of God speaks to the subtitle of my book, "The Human Place in Creation." And as I said, I'll come back to that human task and calling more next week. But today I want to say a little bit more about that rather cryptic title, "Circles and the Cross." I've used those words in my title today, "Christ and Creation, Circles and the Cross." We Christians have usually not thought enough about how to put Christ and creation together. Most of what we hear and think about in church and in Christian thought generally is about Christ and us, what Christ means to both you and me individually and what he means for humanity as a whole. And that is as it should be. It's obviously the main focus of the gospel. But if we stop there, we leave out an important part of the creation story, which is the meaning of Christ for the cosmos, for the whole creation. The Bible does not let us leave out that part of the story. Several texts remind us of it. By the way, I'm not going to spend any time talking about that Proverbs text, which is about wisdom. It was by the early church taken to probably speak of Christ. And yet it speaks of him as the first creation. I won't get into the endless debates about what that text is about, but what it does suggest is that creation in some sense is a communal project of the Trinity, and that it is and it's a matter of delight for God. In any case, I want to share just briefly with you several familiar texts that link Christ, specifically Christ and creation. One of the most obvious of those texts is the one that we heard read this morning from John 1.
Yes,
I don't
that
need to
works.
read this again. In the beginning was the Word. Through him all things were made. But notice how inclusive it is. All things were made through him. That's one text. Perhaps the earliest text is this one that speak of the relationship of Christ and creation, is this one from 1 Corinthians. There is but one God, the Father, from whom all things come and for whom we live, and there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live. So this is probably the earliest written of the New Testament books, and it's clear that this linking of Christ and creation it was a part of the early church. It's even more clear in these familiar words from Colossians. Notice the repetition of all things. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things. There's no question but what the writer Paul wants to stress, that in some sense Christ is involved with all things in creation, not just us. The same words appear in an even more vivid way in the opening to the author of Hebrews. We don't know who wrote Hebrews, but this is what that author says. In these last days, God has spoken to us by his Son, who he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. These texts not only make it clear that we need to link Christ to creation, they also make it clear that Christ is the clearest picture we have of the nature of God, the Creator. As Paul says, God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. Or, as the author of the Hebrews says, the Son is the exact representation of who God is. But when we sing of him like we did at the beginning, I sing the mighty power of God, we probably aren't thinking of Christ. And yet, what do we know of that God who creates? Well, if we can believe what Paul says, Christ is the exact representation. All God's fullness dwells in him. And so, if we want to know what the Creator is like, the clearest picture we have of not only our Redeemer, but the clearest picture we have of our Creator is Christ. But we can't think of Christ without thinking also of the cross. Somehow, the cross is implied in creation. This is clear in that text from Colossians. Christ makes peace over all creation through his blood shed on the cross. Somehow the cross is at the center of creation. Now return with me for a moment to that my title of the book, Circles on the Cross. Now I have a couple of pictures of the Celtic cross. I'm not going to show them to you. You have on your bulletin. I noticed that Rosie included some pictures of Celtic cross from Iona. That ancient Christian symbol of the Celtic cross, a circle up a cross being up a circle being upheld by a cross, is called the Celtic Cross because it appears widely first in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, the Celtic fringe of Britain. Christianity developed there for a while in the 5th and 6th centuries without the influence of Latin Christianity, which chose to think of the relationship of cross and circle in quite a different way. That's another picture of a Celtic cross from Britain. I think it's important to notice that the cross is bigger than the circle. It upholds the circle. And yet it's at the center of the circle. It differs from quite a different way of presenting the relationship of Celtic of cross, the cross and creation. In this image, sometimes it's called the Orb of Empire. You often see it in pictures in the hands of a monarch, a king or a queen or an emperor. Here, the cross is not at the center, it's on top. It's a sign of power and authority. This idea of the cross goes all the way back to the Roman Emperor Constantine in the fourth century, who's said to have had a vision of the cross the night before a battle, accompanied by the words, "In this sign, conquer." And all too often, Christians have seen the cross as a symbol of power. I have to say to you in particular, this group, that the Anabaptist tradition, which you represent, many of you, is a part of, has been a strong witness against this understanding of the cross as an emblem of power, but rather as an emblem of service and sacrifice. The cross at the center of the circle is bigger than the circle, upholds it, and sustain it. This, by the way, is another Celtic cross in front of our house on Galliano Island. And remember that picture of the island because it occurs in the painting. It's on the cover of my book. And the rainbow is suggestive here too. The cross is an emblem of peace, that's what the rainbow suggests. But the rainbow is often, the meaning of the rainbow is often not completely understood because the bow, the Genesis, the Hebrew word translated rainbow in most of our scriptures is simply the word for bow, which is a weapon. And the arch of the rainbow is a weapon drawn towards God, in a sense, in the covenant he makes with all creatures in Genesis 9. God is saying, in a sense, I make myself vulnerable to my creatures. And in a sense, thus, the rainbow is already anticipating the cross. The meanings of the circle in that title and in the Celtic cross, I think, are caught in the subtitle of my book, Cosmos and Consciousness. We experience these two circles every day. We wake up in the middle of them. The first is the miracle of the cosmos. We wake up in a world. Why should there be a world? We should be astonished, like a child. We get bored by the fact that of the miracle of existence. But it's there all around us all the time. Why should there be anything at all? Let alone this beautiful, living, complex world. And the second circle is the miracle of consciousness. We know now that we're made of the dust of exploding stars. I have a picture of one, but I'm not going to show it. I'll show it later. It's taken from the James Webb Telescope. We're made out of stardust. But why should this collection of iron and oxygen and carbon and so forth, it's myself, dust from an exploded star, have an inside as well as an outside? Be an I and not just an it. This is a mystery as great as the mystery of why there should be a universe at all. Why should we be aware of the universe? Why should we be capable of being aware? Philosophers call this the hard problem of consciousness. It's recurred in contemporary philosophy. We can learn all sorts of things about the brain, maybe even create what we now call artificial intelligence, but we will never create artificial consciousness. What does it mean to be aware? Why are we aware? Why do we have an inside? The same is true of the problem of the cosmos. We can learn all kinds of things about the cosmos, but we can't solve the mystery of why. Why should there be something and not nothing, as the philosopher puts it? There's that exploding star picture taken from the James Webb telescope that I described to you, part of the cosmos. And we can learn all sorts of things, as the James Webb telescope is illustrating, about the cosmos, but we can't learn the basic question, why? A philosopher, an astronomer, Robert Jastrow, wrote this about the frustration of going back beyond the Big Bang, beyond the beginning, to answer the why question. It's not a matter of another year, another decade of work, another measurement, or another bit of research. At this moment, it seems to us as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. Well, that points to the fact that we try to answer these big questions about cosmos and consciousness by placing them in stories. The oldest story is that both these circles, both these mysteries or miracles that I call cosmos and consciousness, are the result of a creator. They're part of creation. Of a consciousness which precedes both the cosmos and ourselves. That story, as we all know, has been largely replaced by another default story, the default story of contemporary culture, that the universe is not a creation, but an accident. As one cosmologist puts it, the universe is just one of the things that happens from time to time. Well, it's hard to live in that kind of a universe. And the situation it leaves us in is well described by Bertrand Russell earlier in the 20th century, famous words, that man is the product of causes that had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of an accidental collocation of atoms, that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All of these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Well, that's the philosophy that this story, that the universe is an accident, leaves us with, and it's the philosophy within which much of 20th century and 21st century culture has developed. Woody Allen, that a more dubious philosopher, puts it this way, more than any other time in history, man faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. Let us pray that we have the wisdom to choose correctly. Well, he means that as a joke, but it's a pretty serious joke. And in fact, we can't really live our lives within that kind of a framework. And so we live in a time of intense religious searching. Think of contemporary movements like deep ecology or ecofeminism, neo-paganism, the renewed interest in ancient religions like Buddhism and Hinduism, or the exploration of animist indigenous religions. These are important parts of contemporary culture. Not so often an exploration of Christianity, an attempt to return to the story that this is a creation. And there are some reasons for that, which we need to think seriously about as Christians. One is, for many Christian communities, creation is sort of left out. Our faith is thought about being separate from the world, about going to heaven, not living on the earth. forgetting what we mentioned last week, that heaven, we don't go to heaven in the biblical story. Heaven comes here. Another reason is because Christianity is often associated with empire, dominion, colonialism. That picture of the cross over the circle that I showed you earlier. Yet, though that rejection of Christianity misses the key Christian belief of the centrality of Christ to creation that those earlier texts that I shared speak of, takes us back to the image of the Celtic cross, the love of God at the center of the cosmos. And that story that many Christians are too much shaped by, that our salvation doesn't have much to do with creation, or that Christ doesn't have much to do with creation, misses the central significance of something that we're all getting ready to celebrate, and that is Christmas. So let me conclude by talking a little bit about Christmas and what it tells us about the relationship with Christ and creation. We will listen to and sing a lot of Christmas carols in the next few weeks. Most of them draw on the details of the birth of Jesus described by Matthew and Luke. The pictures they give us of the stable, the shepherds, the wise men are important. They make it plain that God has entered our world, this world of stars, animals, kings, and politics. They make it plain that the Creator in Christ has chosen to enter his creation, to become a creature among us. So Christmas has to make us think about the relationship of Christ and creation. If at the end of the creation story in Genesis, we hear God saying of creation that it's very good, in the costly gift of the incarnation, God is saying it is very, very good. For the incarnation was not only for us, it was for the whole creation, as those texts that we considered earlier from Colossians and Hebrews and John, Corinthians make plain. That fourth century hymn that you sang so beautifully, a cappella, of the Father's love begotten, is one of the few Christmas songs that actually link Christ directly to creation. Of the Father's love begotten, ere the worlds began to be, he the Alpha and Omega, he the source, the ending, he. But most of the details we associate with Christmas come from Matthew and Luke. And that's where the details of most of our Christian Christmas hymns come from. I want to leave you with a curious fact about the Gospel of John. It seems to leave out two things which are important in those other two long Gospels, Matthew and Luke. One is any detail about the birth of Jesus. You'd think John especially would have access to those details because he cared for Jesus' mother. The other thing that seems to be omitted is any description of the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, communion, whatever you call it. The other three Gospels dwell on these, but John doesn't. But as I'll go on to say, these are not really omissions. Let me make this point by sharing with you a remarkable fact. On one level, it's a pure coincidence. On another, perhaps it's an instance of God's sense of humor. And that is, and here I'm going to shift again to some images. This photo is taking place, is of an event which took place on Christmas morning, 2021. It's the launch of the James Webb Telescope that we've already mentioned. There's a picture of that telescope separating from the final stage of the rocket, at the last view anybody had of it. This is an artist's rendering of an exploding star that we saw earlier. This is a picture of what's sometimes called a star nursery, where that stardust is being put together in the ways that our own, that God formed our own selves with. This is a picture of galaxies from very near the beginning of the universe, taken by the James Webb telescope. Now, on the morning that telescope was launched, Christmas texts were being read all around the world. And certainly one of those texts was John's great text, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us." Remember the beginning of that passage. The word that became flesh was the word, let's see, I think I have it here. Through him all things were made. In him was life. That life was the light of all. The light shines in the darkness. The darkness has not overcome it. And the word became flesh and dwelt among us. Among the things the James Webb Telescope is looking for is the possibility of life elsewhere in the cosmos. And its light-gathering mirrors are reaching back towards the light of that very beginning of the universe. Now, I wish the telescope and all those who use it well, but in a sense, those texts that were being read on the morning that coincidentally, it wasn't planned to be launched on Christmas morning, it's sheer coincidence, but it was launched as texts all over the world were being read about the birth of Jesus. And one of the texts certainly was this text, "In the beginning was the Word." As John 1 makes clear, Christ is present in and with all things in creation. The words from John 6 we heard this morning make that clear. "This bread is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world." World, and John, by the way, it translates the Greek word cosmos, which occurs over 70 times in John's gospel, many more times than all the other gospels put together. Throughout the gospel, Jesus links himself with his creation. "I am the bread of life, the water of life. I am the light of the world. I am life itself." So John does not describe the institution of the sacrament, the Lord's Supper, because as the opening words of the gospel make plain, the whole creation is a sacrament. Everything in creation is a gift from the self-giving love of God. We can't be apart from the presence of Christ in and to creation. The specific Lord's Supper, however we regard it, invites us into that gift, what it means for our life in the world, a human place in creation I'll say more about next week. The hymn we're going to sing after this talk reminds us of that, though perhaps it places too much on the idea that it reminds us of heaven and not sending us back to the earth. It's worth remembering that what John describes at the Last Supper is not this presence of himself in and through the bread and wine, which the whole gospel shows, in the I am statement. So, for example, John shows us rather Jesus' act of sacrifice and service in washing his disciples' feet. And he says he does this as an example for our own action. That even greater example is to follow in his crucifixion. The cross tells us what it means to place love and self-giving, most clearly seen in the cross, at the center of our consciousness, our life, as it is at the center of creation. And we'll say quite a bit more of that next week. Now, I want to show you this picture that on the bulletin that Rosie included. It's on the cover of my book. And it's actually a painting that has an interesting history. It was done by an artist who came to Regent to study landscape painting back in about the time we moved to Galliano. He visited us several times on Galliano and one of the, then as now, there were lots of arguments about logging. And Galliano was at the center of one of them. And he painted this painting during Holy Week, the week before Easter, at the request of his church. They arranged with The Oak Street Mall. What's it called? I can't remember. That thing that has now huge skyscrapers being built all over it. He painted it at the mall during Holy Week. It's called Easter Journey. And that picture on the right, the green island, or the left, is the island in front of our house. I showed it to you in a picture earlier. The picture in the center is that island clear cut, that island logged. Picture on the right is a mountain lake that we had hiked to. But of course, that picture in the center is not only the island logged, it's the head of the crucified Christ. And if you follow the ridge line from the left to the right, it becomes the arms of the crucified Christ. The painting is in deliberate dialogue with this famous painting by Salvador Dali, Christ of St. John of the Cross. But Dali, it's a great painting, but Dali gets it wrong theologically. The painting is suspended above creation. Lindsay, in his painting, gets it right. Christ is embedded in creation, embracing creation. That love of God is at the center of creation. The cross is at the center of creation. The figure on the right, not only a mountain lake, which he painted for a variety of reasons, it's also an empty tomb. And so the cross does point to the resurrection. Next week, we'll talk more about what the cross at the center of our consciousness means for our action in the world, and the fact that the story of Jesus and the story of creation certainly doesn't end at the crucifixion. It ends and, in a sense, begins with the resurrection. So we'll go there next week. The cross tells us what it means to be conscious in the world. It tells us why creation is a gift, that creation is a gift of the self-giving love of God. I'll stop there. Thank you.